I Hate the News is the weekly news bulletin from I Hate Politics podcast, a show about a human activity we love to hate. I am Sunil Dasgupta. The week of October 22nd, 2024. It is high election season. Ads on TV, flyers in the mailbox, candidate literature on the doorstep, door knocking in swing states, and our story, postcarding out of the DC region. Building associations and labor unions file a lawsuit against Montgomery County, which is supposed to be developing new rules to ban gas appliances in new construction, shaping the fight over climate change. The New Jersey company, tasked with building a transmission line from Baltimore to Frederick, releases route information, but opposition continues. And more. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program. If your goal is to make a meaningful impact with a career in local, state, or federal government, discover what this degree can do for you. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society functioning precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaracina on guitar and vocals, Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals, Evan Hurd on bass, and Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends. Last week, there was a shortage of first-class stamps in local post offices here in Montgomery County because people were bulk buying them for postcarding campaigns out of the super blue Washington, D.C. region to other parts of the country. Postcarding is now a growing part of campaigns. I asked D.C. resident and self-described postcard lady Charlotte Bensada how it works and how big it has become.
I was 2 weeks ago at the Brentwood Post Office, which is the major distribution center in DC, and they told me they had sold 30,000 over a 2 week period and that they were out and they were doing extra orders. When I started in 2017, it was a relatively novel effort started by a guy named Tony the Democrat that's based in Atlanta. Since that time, there are at least a dozen organizations that do either very general postcarding, like postcards for swing states, which sends this very brief message essentially saying that who you vote for is private, and but otherwise everyone knows you're voting, sort of a social pressure message, or what my daughter calls vaguely threatening. Then there's a bunch of them that are very, very focused on candidates, that are focused on getting a Democratic message out that is, and those can be year round. And then there's a very, very focused, concentrated effort around election time. There's a group in California called Activate America, which is really actually focused on spreading a message. Democrats have done this. Your Republican congressman has not done that. Then there are a bunch of us that are focused on what we call down ballot races, the school boards, the state legislative races, where there's just not name recognition. People will leave these things blank because they don't know.
Talk a little bit about the scale of this operation. I mean, you've written, what did you say, 6,000 postcards since June?
Well, I should say my neighborhood have. And our biggest effort was around 3,000 going to Maryland for some school board races.
You are, you know, writing a postcard, putting in the mail, and you don't really know who the person is that is getting it.
Right. We're literally addressing it as high voter.
But do you sometimes address them by name?
Well, it depends on the campaign. Postcards for Virginia uses names. There's some feeling that using names is is a positive thing. There are those people who have concerns about using names because sometimes you're outing people for being a Democrat, which may be the kid and the parents are not, might be the wife and the husband is not. I mean, there's some really interesting debates that are happening with this. There's also research that says people feel more spoken to if their name is there. So it's always a fine balance.
These lists are generated out of the same data that is publicly available that is used for door knocking and calling people, right?
Correct.
Compared to door knocking, writing postcards in a group with friends, neighbors, seems like it's joyous.
It can be a fabulous experience, yes. I mean, you know, and we did a lot more group writes before COVID. I mean, we would literally have 20 of us and we would knock out 400 or 500 at a time. Since COVID, we've had some, but they're smaller groups. What we still did, we started during COVID, was porch drops and bring them back and forth. And, you know, I am known as the postcard lady in our neighborhood. And I help people get on there, but I tend to provide the postcards. I'll do very large Vistaprint purchases and kind of see what I can do to empower people.
Now, you've done it for several years now. What do you know about the efficacy of this effort?
There are studies out there that it could increase anything from 1% to 2%. It is most effective in what they call low noise environments, meaning that, you know, that there's not a lot of other advertising.
Is postcarding increasingly integrated in the menu of things that campaigns do?
Yes. That's a good way to use volunteers, too. I mean, frankly, you just have people who cannot just do some of the more traditional things, but they can do these.
Apart from, obviously, busy moms, what other demographic groups participate in postcarding?
I know that many, many synagogues actually do just more general get out the vote cards. Theirs tend to be nonpartisan, but I would say this is women driven. I would say 70 to 80% are women.
Charlotte, what has postcarding given you personally?
Well, it's given me an alternative to going to Ben and Jerry's.
Is writing letters meditative for you?
Yes, it's like a mantra. I really love being able to write, vote for this person. They're going to do these things. This is a positive message. And the other part of this is it reinforces that democracy is many, many small acts. And that if it's one person who can do everything, well, then it's not a democracy.
Here with an update from the Montgomery County Board of Elections is Gilberto Zelaya, known everywhere as Dr. Z.
You can still leverage same-day voter registration in person during the early voting season or on Election Day, November 5th. All you need to bring is a Maryland driver's license, permit, or ID. And if you don't have a current, the three forms of ID, you can bring a utility bank statement, utility bill, and other governmental document that has your name and Montgomery County address.
Early voting starts next week, right?
Yes, early voting is right around the corner from Thursday, the 24th of October through Thursday, the 31st of October. We have 14 early voting centers. What's nice about early voting is you're not tied to the nearest early voting center. So if you're running errands, you're coming from work, you're going to work, identify any of the 14 locations. All you need to do is grab your cell phone, text the word, the letters actually, E and V plus the zip code, E and V plus your zip code to 77788. It will give you the nearest early voting centers, address, driving directions, and most importantly, the wait times.
What's going on with vote by mail?
Well, vote by mail, right now we have about a little over 172,000 Montgomery County voters requesting to vote by mail. In-house, we have received about 62,000, a little over 62,000. We have held our first canvass, actually. A little over 16,000 mail-in ballots have been canvassed and getting ready to be scanned. With the canvass, they're both live streamed and you could come in person. We invite everyone to come, even for 30 minutes, to observe participatory democracy. It's part of the process. Everything is done literally by bipartisan teams, individuals of opposite parties. We're at the Montgomery College Germantown Bioscience Education Center. The canvas starts at 10, ends up between 5 and 6. By all means, swing there, bring your kids. Our next canvas is this coming Saturday. Everything is on our website, the calendar, agenda, etc., at 777votes.org.
Your website also has a streaming link.
Yes. So when you go to our homepage, 777vote.org, there's a link. Click on it. It'll give you the live stream and also the calendar of our upcoming canvases and times. So for those individuals who still have a desire to vote by mail, grab your cell phone, text the letters VBM, VBM to 77788. The deadline to request the vote by mail packet is October 29th. And if you need to vote a web delivery, print at home, mail-in ballot, then that deadline is on November 1st.
Gilberto Zelaya, thank you so much. See you next time.
My pleasure, my friend. Take care.
Two infrastructure stories next. First, PSEG, the New Jersey company, tasked with building a high-voltage power transmission line from the north of Baltimore to the south of Frederick, called the Maryland-Piedmont Reliability Project, MPRP, has released the proposed path, which seems to avoid major population centers, but skirts close to others, including Urbana, which sits on the border of Frederick and Montgomery counties. The project is expected to impact 600 property parcels in Frederick, Carroll, and Baltimore counties. Not surprisingly, there has been fierce opposition to the project, led particularly by affected farmers, the farm bureaus, and others who believe that the power line will negatively affect their properties. Most recently, Maryland's retiring U.S. Senator Ben Cardin wrote a letter opposing the project. Maryland's Public Service Commission has to approve the project and the specific route, and they would look at whether the company has been able to buy easements prior to submitting their applications to the commission. Joanne Frederick, whose land in Baltimore County is expected to be affected, founded the Stop MPRP group. Here is her approach to stopping the project.
We move into the next phase of our fight to stop the proposed MPRP. Regardless of this proposed final route, we all remain in this together. Yes, my family farm is impacted, but even if it was not, I will fight with the same tenacity and determination. The proposed route can and likely will still change. None of us are free from this threat until we stop it in its entirety. For those on the route, you are under no legal obligation to negotiate with PSEG. Just say no. If PSEG is forced to take this proposed route to the Maryland Public Service Commission with zero easement agreements in hand, our position to get the project canceled will be much, much stronger. Two final things to keep in mind. Every single person who pays a utility bill will pay for this ill-conceived project. So even if you are not on the proposed route, your utility bill will go up. If we allow this project to happen, there will be more in the future. We must not allow this precedent to be set.
There is considerable back and forth over the benefits of the new power line. The regional grid called PJM, which serves Maryland, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and 10 other states going all the way to Illinois, has claimed that the project is important because it will improve reliability within the grid, and specifically allow the coal-fired generating plants called Brandon Shores and Wagner in Maryland to be phased out. But the justification for the power line itself says that it will connect in Baltimore County to another line that brings electricity from the Peach Bottom nuclear power plant in Pennsylvania, and then on the other side from Frederick, connect under the Potomac River to Loudoun County in Virginia, where data centers and electricity demand have exploded, So the line will serve demand in Virginia by routing Pennsylvania-generated power to move through Maryland. Maryland itself, and particularly Frederick County, is looking at new data centers as well. So the line could in the future benefit the state of Maryland itself, but this benefit will come at a cost because a part of this project will be borne by Maryland ratepayers. Meanwhile, the coal-fired plants at Brandon Shores and Wagner will continue to run and will be paid higher than market rates for their electricity. This will be borne mainly by Maryland ratepayers until the transmission line is complete. The state government has largely stayed out of the fight, but 2 weeks ago, the chair of Maryland's Public Service Commission, Fred Hoover, on this podcast, called for aggressive state intervention in power planning, something that has not happened since Maryland deregulated electricity in 1999 under Governor Paris Glendening. The second infrastructure story is about Montgomery County's 2022 law, which asks for new rules that would make most new construction all electric. That is, these projects would not have appliances such as water heaters, HVAC stoves, fueled by gas, which is a fossil fuel. The law required the new rules to be in place by December 31st, 2026, which is 2 years away. Now, the National Association of Home Builders, Restaurant Law Center, National Federation of Independent Business, Maryland Building Industry Association, Washington Gas, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington Laborers District Council, and Teamsters Local 96 have filed a lawsuit in federal district court in Maryland to stop the law from taking effect. The plaintiffs argue that Montgomery County does not have the authority to ban gas appliances, which is authority given by the United States Congress to the EPA. Further, gas appliance ban will cause damage to the plaintiffs, their members, and their businesses. The state of Maryland has also passed new building energy standards, and these state rules may clash with those being developed by the county. The new all-electric law would affect all buildings, including significant renovation of current buildings. Taken together, electrification concerns are going to be front and center in the coming years and sit atop the effort to balance between climate goals and economic growth, including expanding housing stock to meet the massive pent-up demand and housing affordability. That's all for this episode. Be sure to check out our feature interview series that comes out Friday mornings. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. area post-punk rock band Gray Swift. Mike Mangiaricino on guitar and vocals. Fabrizio Cariani on guitar and backing vocals. Evan Hurd on bass. And Chris Blackburn on the drums. The songs come from their album, Closure Ends.